Well, the news is that it's Thanksgiving, and this year my family's making two turkeys, meaning I'm making two turkeys. This episode is all about our turkey day, which wasn't really about turkeys when it all started some 400 years ago.
It will come as a surprise, I imagine, to most of your listeners that the Wampanoags have been in contact with European colonists for a century before the Mayflower arrived. This was not a first contact episode.
Wow, for a century.
A century. The first documented, and this is only the first documented, case of contact between the Wampanoags and Europeans is 1524. And that's between the Wampanoags and a French-employed Italian sailor named Giovanni de Verrazzano, after
whom... It's like 96 years earlier.
So there had been an attempt to found a colony in Maine, a colony called Sagadahoc, in 1607, same year as Jamestown.
Oh.
That colony failed. And I think it's important to keep in mind, most attempts to found colonies before 1620 failed. Roanoke's a famous example.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The coast is littered with failed attempts by the English, the French, and the Spanish to found colonies. And why the colonies usually fail is poor relations with indigenous people. Some European ship, we don't know which one, had inadvertently introduced an epidemic. We don't know which one. I suspect it was smallpox, but we don't know. But it had introduced an epidemic into native southern New England that eviscerated the Wampanoag people. We're talking about population losses approaching 80, 90%, according to native accounts after the fact, which is an inconceivable loss. So when the Mayflower arrives, the Wampanoags are desperate. The population is diminished. They're facing subjugation at the hands of their Narragansett enemies. And here's the ship full of people with guns and metal tools and other weaponry, with whom the Wampanoags might be able to form an alliance, not because the Wampanoags are friendly, not because they want to establish an English society among them that will overwhelm them, because they want allies against their intertribal rivals.
Eels.
Eels.
We're not talking sushi. We're talking eels.
We're talking eels, of which there were many around Plymouth. There's no butter. So imagine Thanksgiving without butter.
I know.
There's no flour. There's no sugar.
Did you know that the Indians and Pilgrims didn't plan for a feast together in that famous Thanksgiving of 1621? In fact, the Pilgrims had already started the feast and festivities when, for reasons that you'll find out in this episode, the Indians showed up uninvited and unannounced. And did you know that Indians and Pilgrims didn't have a second Thanksgiving the next year, in 1622, or in 1623, or in 1624, or in any other year after that? Hey there, News Peelers. Today is Wednesday, November 22, 2023. It's the day before Thanksgiving. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink or both, and let's get into it. Back in 2021, Thanksgiving wasn't just a festive and family day in our calendar. It was real news, kind of big news for people like me who are into American history. You see, Thanksgiving 2021 was the 400th anniversary of that first Thanksgiving in Plymouth in 1621. 400 years makes for a long tradition. While we celebrate this wonderful tradition, and should celebrate it, it also behooves us to better understand it. How did it all start? Does the history of that first Thanksgiving comport with the stories that we learned in school and at home when we were kids? To peel some of this history, Thanksgiving history, we've decided to make our own tradition here at History Behind News by having conversations about Thanksgiving. To do that, back in 2021, I spoke with Dr. David Silverman of George Washington University's Department of History, Columbian College of Arts and Sciences, where he's a professor of early America and Native America. He has written several books on these subjects. In this episode, we discuss his book titled This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. To learn more about Dr. Silverman, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Silverman and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast, and if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right, for the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Professor Silverman, it is such a pleasure to have you on our program today. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. In 2019, you published a book titled This Land is Their Land. But the title is actually longer than this, and I think it's important for our audience to hear the whole title. Why don't you please read out the title in its entirety for our audience, and then tell us, what is this book about?
Sure. The title is This Land is Their Land, which is a play on the song, the Woody Guthrie song. And the subtitle is The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving.
Troubled History of Thanksgiving.
That's correct. That's correct. And by troubled, I mean, what I'm referring to is that we have this myth that is part of American tradition. That is incorrect. It's historically incorrect. And moreover, that I contend does some real social and cultural damage, especially to Indigenous people. And that's what I mean by the term troubled.
What kind of, when you say social and cultural damage, before I ask about the sort of damage it inflicts on Indigenous people, does it also have cultural repercussions for sort of ethnic majorities, racial majorities?
Yes. I mean, we're experiencing a moment right now, and, you know, this has happened cyclically through my life, and I know throughout American history, where we have progress on the subject of race, which is to say that, you know, people begin to scrutinize the role of race in our society, and to try to address the inequalities and the injustices that stem from our racial constructions, which after all are inventions. They have nothing to do with nature. And then it produces a backlash, right? In which parts of society say, you know, you're taking this too far, or, you know, you're ruining our faith in our nation, or you're dividing
our traditions.
Right. That's exactly right. And Thanksgiving is part of that discussion. You know, when I say that the myth is troubled, what I'm referring to is that it's a feel-good story about a fundamentally bloody process, which is colonialism. And I submit that the reluctance, particularly of white Americans, to confront how utterly brutal the colonization of this country was, including by the United States itself at the expense of Native nations, leaves us less equipped to cast a critical eye on our society today. And so a critical view of history is essential to a critical view of our present and future.
I think this explanation sets me up for my next question and sort of answers it. Right at the introduction of your book, you make the following statement. Serious critical history tends to be hard on the living. I had to read the sentence, admittedly, a couple of times to really sort of, it's thought-provoking. It's a bold statement, hard on the living. What do you mean by this? Serious critical history.
Right. It means taking a hard look at the past as it was rather than as we want it to have been. Most societies create myths that make those societies appear just and the product of timeless positive values.
Is that a bad thing?
I think it is. I think it is a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with celebrating positive values. But we do ourselves and we do historical truth a disservice when we render complicated historical actors who, you know, had positive and negative qualities, who did good things and bad things, and instead we turn them into these demigods who could do no wrong. That's not a reasonable model for us or for future generations, and it's not reasonable to impose that sanitized view on people in the past who were much more complicated than that. We're better able to address our own shortcomings and victories if we can see the people of the past in three-dimensional form.
And what you're proposing is intellectually rigorous, isn't it?
It's intellectually rigorous in this respect. And the challenge that I'm posing here, when I say that serious critical history is hard on the living, and then I apply that principle to the Thanksgiving story, by the living, I not only mean white Americans, I mean all Americans, including indigenous people, because there's a hard story for indigenous people in the tale that I'm telling too. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a challenge that asks all of us to think about historical actors in the past, not as we, but as they. In other words, you know,
wait, say that again, please.
Sure.
To look at historical actors in the past as not we, as rather than they.
That is correct. You know, one of the things that has always struck me is the way in which my college students, let me phrase this differently. My white college students, who come from any one of a variety of backgrounds, right? Some of them are Italian American, some of them are Polish American, some of them are Jewish Americans, blah, blah, blah. They will refer to English colonists from the 17th century they have been conditioned by virtue of growing up in this country to think of themselves as white people, right? An identity which their forebears did not have. And then they use that to connect to the story of the white people in America. Now let's be clear, they don't descend from those people at all. They don't refer.
In fact, they were discriminated. Their ancestors may have been discriminated by those people that we call we, right?
That's precisely right. But they don't refer to Native Americans of the past as we. Now, they don't descend from them either. The descendants both of the English and of Native people are their fellow Americans today. I have also found, and this is an interesting pattern, none of my students of color of any description refer to people from the 17th and 18th century as we, unless they're native. Native people do it all the time. And what I think that mindset does is it makes both white people and indigenous people less able to view their own ancestors in a critical light. And the fact of the matter is this, all of their ancestors did good things and bad things. They had triumphs and they made mistakes. Nobody wants to refer to the we of the past as having made serious mistakes, as having behaved in ways that were horrific or that were unfathomable to us. And yet all of us have those people in our backgrounds.
Why did you pick this book? Why Thanksgiving? There are many different epics throughout Native American history, post-colonialism, that are unfortunate and really have impacts on their fates and lives. Why Thanksgiving?
There were a few reasons. One was this. I've been writing about Native American history for the better part of 25 years.
Yes.
And I began my career by working on the Wampanoags, and that historical work involved outreach to modern day Wampanoag people on Martha's Vineyard in Cape Cod. And what they told me repeatedly was how hard Thanksgiving season was for them, and especially for their children. That at best, it seemed as if the rest of American society was ignoring their historical plight. And at worst, it seemed to them that American society was reveling in it. And that hurt was magnified in school settings when Wampanoag
people... Or as Thanksgiving plays and everything, right?
That's precisely right. In which Wampanoag kids had to perform in these Thanksgiving pageants. I don't know if Thanksgiving pageants are familiar to all your readers, but these are these plays that are very common in New England and other parts of the Northeast, in which grade school kids dress up in cartoonish fashion, like pilgrims with giant buckles on every conceivable article of clothing, and as Indians, by which I mean Plains Indians. I mean, they look like they rode out of a Hollywood Western into New England.
And so different than New England and Native Americans, right?
Oh, yeah, they're vastly different. Yeah. But, you know, America homogenizes all Native people to Hollywood stereotypes. And these plays are all about are friendly Indians effectively handing over their country to the English so the English can create the United States. And then the Indians just disappear. Nobody knows how. And what's more, Wampanoag people have told me how frequently teachers who were involved in these plays would tell the students that the New England Indians had all disappeared, they'd just vanished, even as they had Native kids sitting there in front of them. Right? So that was one reason. Another reason is that I regularly participate in these teacher training institutes for primary and secondary school history instructors. And I usually do so through Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens, is George Washington's ancestral estate. And you know, we talk about the American Revolution, indigenous people, and so on and so forth. But the teachers always, when it's time for Q&A, what they want to ask me about is less George Washington and Native America than the history of the first Thanksgiving, because all of them teach it. It's the one cameo appearance of indigenous people in the American history curriculum for the colonial period.
It's actually a good point. You're right. It is one of the few instances in which pretty much all schools across America purport to teach about Native Americans. They mention Native Americans, right?
Right. And they do it during Native American Heritage Month. And almost every single one of these teachers said to me, I feel totally ill-equipped to address this subject with the depth that it deserves. So I wrote this book for Wampanoag people who told me their stories. I wrote this book for teachers on the front lines who reach millions of American school kids every year. And then finally, you know, the final reason is it's an anniversary. And 2020 was the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower. 2021 is the 400th anniversary of the so-called first Thanksgiving. And for reasons that are beyond my ken, anniversaries have a way of focusing the public's attention on these historical episodes. If I wrote this book 2 years from now or 2 years before now, no one would pay attention to it. But if it falls on an anniversary, well, then you can reach a wider audience.
That's a good point. And we're having this podcast now because it is the 400th anniversary of the famous quote-unquote Thanksgiving. We're going to talk about these fascinating points that you brought up.
Wampanoag Indians, how they supposedly vanished, and education about Native Americans. But before we get into that, I just wanted to briefly sort of touch on an interesting parallel history of source for you, just to clarify it for me and our audience, please. As I understand it, Jamestown contended with Plymouth for being a source of our Thanksgiving tradition as well. And I think at one point, even President Kennedy was making a declaration about Thanksgiving, and he had to include Jamestown in his history. Am I correct in this? And if so, how significant was their claim?
Yeah, it's one of the silliest battles. Let's be clear about this.
Uh-huh.
Native Americans had been celebrating Thanksgivings of their own for who knows how long, perhaps even thousands of years before the arrival of Europeans. Every European nation had its own Thanksgiving tradition of one sort or another. Virginia had Thanksgivings. Plymouth Colony had Thanksgivings. There's no first in all of the.
Yeah, actually, Spanish actually held them first.
Right. Every human group across the world has days in which they offer thanks to their spirits when a drought ends or a military victory happens or any one of a number of pleasant things. So you are effectively swimming against the tide if you're trying to find the first of these rituals.
Why don't we take a short break and then talk about the events leading up to the famous 1621 Thanksgiving. In addition to Thanksgiving, here at History Behind News, we are setting up for another tradition, the tradition of peeling the history behind Christmas. So be sure to check back with us later in December, probably on December 20th, when we publish a new episode on the history of Christmas. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Silverman about the history of Thanksgiving. Professor Silverman, before we get into the history of Thanksgiving itself, please paint a picture for us of what was happening, transpiring in North America during the months prior to the arrival of the pilgrims to Plymouth.
Well, there's a lot of context that needs to go into understanding especially why the Wampanoags did what they did when they decided to permit the Mayflower passengers to settle in their country and then reached out to them in ways that included the feast that we now call the first Thanksgiving. Let me start with this basic principle, which might seem obvious to your listeners when it's stated, but that most people don't think about all that much, which is this, that what the Thanksgiving myth and many of our history lessons purport to have been a new world was nothing of the sort. That the Americas were an old world with ancient civilizations that had existed for thousands of years. And that Europeans did not discover the Americas, that people had already been here for quite a long time. And that's important background to understand that this was not a wilderness. It was a settled place with active people living their lives and coping with all of the challenges that day-to-day existence posed to them. Those challenges began to increase significantly and become much more serious in the years leading up to 1620. It will come as a surprise, I imagine, to most of your listeners that the Wampanoags had been in contact with European colonists for a century before the Mayflower arrived. This was not a first contact episode.
Wow, for a century.
A century. The first documented, and this is only the first documented, case of contact between the Wampanoags and Europeans is 1524. And that's between the Wampanoags and a French-employed Italian sailor named Giovanni de Verrazano, after
it's
whom...
It's like 96 years earlier.
Right. And he might not have been the first. He's only the first for which we have records. And the pace of those contacts between European explorers and the Wampanoags and other native people along the coast picked up significantly between 1602 and 1620. They were becoming, those contacts were taking place several times a year, and they tended not to go well. Sometimes they began with trade and would degenerate into violence, you know, when one party or the other overreacted to the other side's provocations or imagined provocations. But worse still was there was this pattern of Europeans raiding the coast for captives, seizing indigenous people and then hauling them back across the Atlantic, either for sale into slavery or for training as interpreters and guides for future voyages. And the Wampanoags had suffered many of these raids over the course of years, and as such had developed a healthy caution whenever they saw one of these ships bobbing off the coast. They certainly coveted the trade of these newcomers. These newcomers had metal. These native people were people without metal, and you know, these folks have hatchets and knives and kettles and such, never mind the other goods that they boast. But they also represented danger, and so native people were cautious about that. The danger they represented also was epidemic disease. And between 1616 and 1619, some European ship, we don't know which one, had inadvertently introduced an epidemic. We don't know which one. I suspect it was smallpox, but we don't know. But it had introduced an epidemic into native southern New England that eviscerated the Wampanoag people. We're talking about population losses approaching 80, 90%, according to native accounts after the fact, which is an inconceivable loss to people today. Think about the panic and the tumult that we're going through with COVID, and our losses are a mere fraction of what these people suffered. We know what's happening. They didn't even know what was happening. They didn't know what this disease was. They didn't know where it came from. They didn't know what had caused it. And in the wake of this catastrophic loss of population, the Wampanoags begin experiencing raids from their Narragansett rivals, Narragansett Indian rivals, to their west. Narragansett's inhabited what's now Rhode Island, still do. The Wampanoags were a little farther to the east. The Narragansetts hadn't contracted the disease. So when the Mayflower arrives, the Wampanoags are desperate. The population is diminished. They're facing subjugation at the hands of their Narragansett enemies. And here's the ship full of people with guns and metal tools and other weaponry with whom the Wampanoags might be able to form an alliance. Not because the Wampanoags are friendly, not because they want to establish an English society among them that will overwhelm them, because they want allies against their intertribal rivals. That's the basic context for this outreach to the Mayflower passengers. Were they wary of them? No question. Again, they had suffered years of raids at the hands of people like this. But that danger also meant that perhaps they could harness the power of these people and direct it against their Narragansett rivals.
The passengers of the Mayflower in the 100-year history that you were sharing with me since 1524, and they were the first attempt to settle in the area, right? Prior attempts were raids, as far as we know.
That's a somewhat difficult question to answer. So there had been an attempt to found a colony in Maine, a colony called Sagadahoc in 1607, same year as Jamestown.
Oh,
that colony failed. And I think it's important to keep in mind, most attempts to found colonies before 1620 failed. Roanoke's a famous example. The coast is littered with failed attempts by the English, the French, and the Spanish to found colonies. And why the colonies usually fail is poor relations with indigenous people.
So the way you're describing this kind of is counter to popular history, where they talk about how the Pilgrims happened upon the coast of Massachusetts, that they found Plymouth. If they had already been in contact with these people for many decades, there ought to have been maritime maps of the coast.
Yes. It goes beyond that. One of the sailors on the Mayflower had already been to southern New England. And he's the one who suggests to them when they anchor initially off the very tip of Cape Cod that perhaps they could build a settlement at what we now call Plymouth. It was a Wampanoag town called Patuxent. And what he said was, all the people there have been wiped out by this disease. There's no one there to contest your settling. And what's more, the land is already cleared because of Wampanoag cornfields. So you don't have to go through the labor, the incredible labor of cutting down the woods in order to establish your planting fields. The work's already done for you.
There's no shrubbery. It's all clean for farming. Let's go back to something that you said, and you bring this up in your book. You have a picture in your book of the rotunda of the Capitol. I had to jog my memory to see whether or not I remember that actually to my visit there. But it's essentially, there is carved in relief into sandstone the scene of a Native American presenting, I think it's corn, to pilgrims who are sort of getting off the boat and coming ashore. And next to this image in your book, you say the myth of friendly Indians. And you brought it up again in our conversation.
Yeah.
Squanto was a friendly Indian, Native American. We learned that in our grade school, right? Put that in perspective for us, please.
Okay, sure. When in the rare moments where Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer strike a deal, we don't say they did so because they are friendly towards one another. They're being strategic. That's kind of the glib response I have to this characterization.
Well, I mean, because it's just
white Americans love stories about Native Americans who helped. That relief in the rotunda of the Capitol that you mentioned is not standing alone. It is alongside a image in stone of Pocahontas saving John Smith from his execution. And next to that is William Penn and the Delaware Indians having their treaty under the Tree of Peace, in which the Delaware cede their land to the English. And it goes on. And
I don't remember any of these. They're all there in that relief, sort of these feel-good images.
That's right. It's bloodless colonialism. It's Native people who help. And
accepted us with open arms.
That's right.
Let's talk about that 1621 Thanksgiving. And I use the word Thanksgiving in quotation marks because I know that wasn't what it was called then. Please describe that first event. How close is it to our tradition now?
It's close to our tradition only in the vaguest of ways. So there was a feast. Yep. It did take place at Plymouth.
Was it in November?
We don't know. It was in the fall sometime. Okay. And the two accounts we have don't say. We know the harvest is in, but that could mean it's September or October. It's really hard to say. We know that the number of English people was dwarfed by that of the Wampanoags. There's upwards of 90 to 100 Wampanoags who show up at this thing. There are only 50 English colonists at Plymouth. When the Wampanoags first show up, they're startled. They're all men, the Wampanoags who show up, and they're armed. As far as the English could tell right away, they're there to get massacred. I mean, they're arriving to massacre them. Turns out not to have been the case. Most of the foods that we associate with that feast would not have been there.
Did they have turkey?
They almost certainly had turkey, even though the only two accounts of the feast say they had fowl with a W. And so that certainly means ducks and geese. But an earlier entry in the journal of William Bradford, the governor of Plymouth, says that the colony had bagged a lot of turkeys earlier that season. So there's almost certainly turkey. But most of the rest of the meal would have consisted of shellfish, fish, including eels.
Eels. We're not talking sushi. We're talking eels.
We're talking eels, of which there were many around Plymouth. We're talking about corn, corn stews, fundamentally Native American food here. Corn stews with squash, maybe with berries, with meat mixed in, fish mixed in. There's no butter. So imagine Thanksgiving without butter.
I know.
There's no flour. There's no sugar. So
sugar I can see, but no flour?
They weren't growing wheat.
Oh, yeah.
They were growing corn.
Yeah.
So there might have been cornmeal and you know, a wide range of Native American dishes from this region centered on processing cornmeal. It could be a stew, it could be some form of cornbread or pancake, but no wheat flour, no.
Interesting.
And so that means most of our, there's no potatoes. Most of our dishes that we consider to be traditional are fairly recent developments.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about what happened after the 1621 Thanksgiving. Hey there, News Peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on U.S. politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy, and also a series on revolutions and protests like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. Professor Silverman, so the Pilgrims and Native Americans have Thanksgiving in 1621. Did they have a second Thanksgiving together, let's say in 1622?
No.
No.
They most certainly did not.
Why not?
Well, the English actually sent an emissary to the Wampanoag leader, Usamequin or Massasoit, and say to him, you people have to stop showing up unannounced at our colony. Because when you do, A, it frightens us, and B, we have to feed y'all, and we don't have enough to go around. So they give him.
I got to ask this question then, Professor Silverman. Was the first Thanksgiving, I think you alluded to this, was that an unannounced as well, or were
yes.
they invited?
Oh, the English did not invite these folks to come. What happened was Wampanoag oral tradition has helped to inform me on this point. The English are firing guns, they're engaged in celebratory gunfire. The hard work of the harvest is done. They're going to take a couple days off. There's some drinking involved. The men are outside going through military drills, target practice and the like. Well, the Wampanoags have a defensive alliance with these folks. And among the threats that Plymouth Colony was guarding against was not only the threat of indigenous people in southern New England, the Narragansetts above all, but the French. Because the French knew that the English were engaged in this enterprise, and the French claimed this stretch of coast as their own. And so there was every reason to believe that a French vessel or fleet could sail into Plymouth Harbor and wipe the place out. So the Wampanoags hear this gunfire, and they show up in mass, armed, ready to help these people with whom they had formed an alliance.
I always thought they were invited to a feast.
No. The feast is already going on. they contribute to the feast. They send out some of their men and haul back. I think it's three deer or something like that. But the problem of showing up unannounced to the English is a very real one. So they give the Wampanoag leader Massasoit or Usamequin, as his formal name was, a necklace. And they say, look, when you're sending someone to talk with us, have him put on this necklace and we'll know that he came from you. Otherwise, tell your people to stop dropping by.
Okay, I guess that kind of makes sense.
I'll tell you what, from a defensive purpose, it did make sense, because in the year 1622, the Powhatan Indians, in whose territory Jamestown was founded.
So we're going all the way down to Virginia now.
Right. They launch a surprise attack against the English in that year, in which they kill the English with their own tools. I mean, they make it look like they're just there for casual visits, as they were in the custom of doing, and then turned in an instant on these colonists. So the colonists of Plymouth know that if you have this pattern of casual interaction with your indigenous neighbors, you're opening yourself up for a surprise attack. And they most certainly did not want to do that.
So the colonists and the Wampanoag Native Americans are quote unquote friends. They're allies in 1621. At some point, they're no longer allies. What happens? And you say school teachers now say they vanished. Like, what happens?
Well, I think we should call them frenemies from the beginning. Just to say, you know, they have agreed to cooperate in matters of trade and military affairs, but they don't trust each other. Not much. Even from the beginning, there was a critical mass of Wampanoag people who thought that this decision by their leader, Usumeequinna Massasoit, to ally with these English was crazy. You know, what they said was, we know what the behavior of these people has been over the course of several years. They, you know, they've been raiding our coast, they've been enslaving our people, attacking us unprovoked. What do you think is going to happen with this place? And the answer is, he didn't know. Of course, he didn't know what was coming down the pike. All he knows is he's facing an emergency right now in the form of the Narragansetts, and these people can help him get through it. It's a short-term decision. In the short term, it was the right decision. The Wampanoags maintained their independence because, in part, they had the backing of the English, who came to their defense more than once in this ongoing intertribal war.
Sounds like a great story so far.
And it very quickly degenerates.
The reason that
is difficult to say. Mm-hmm. What I can say is this: you know, we often call the period between we, by which I mean the collective we. We say, well, 50 years of peace passed between you know, the first Thanksgiving and then the Great War, King Philip's War. Between the English colonists of New England and the Wampanoags and their indigenous neighbors. Well, that 50-year period of peace was marred by regular war scares between the two sides. I mean, there was a constant fear that war was about to break out, that one side was conspiring against the other, and both groups harbored this fear. And the reason they harbored this fear is that whereas Plymouth Colony was a nothing place, right? It starts with 50 people who can barely feed themselves. Half of them are women and children, right?
Some of them actually die in the first winter, right?
Half of them die. They go from 100 people on the Mayflower to 50 in the course of months.
Yeah.
They are no threat to Wampanoag sovereignty.
Okay.
But the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which is founded in 1629, most certainly is. It begins with what we call the Great Migration. And that's the influx of upwards of 15,000 people in less than 10 years into the colony. Now, 15,000 people might not sound like a lot to
now, but it was a lot then.
It's the size of the greatest tribes. Very few of these tribes had more than 15,000 people. What's more, these English colonists reproduced like rabbits. The average English woman who came over on the Great Migration had 8 children over the course of her life. 8. And they're living. The children are living there. It's not like in the middle of London where half the kids are going to die before they reach a young age. On average, 6.5 of every 8 kids are living to adulthood, and not only living to adulthood, but reaching their 70s and 80s. So this is a recipe for a population explosion. What's more, these English colonists come with livestock, right? Cattle, horses, sheep, pigs, which reproduced like livestock. And the English make no attempt to fence in these animals. They just let them range over the country. Well, where these animals are attracted is to Native American cornfields and clam banks, which hogs, most of your listeners probably don't realize, hogs dig up clams.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
They are an environmental shock force. And Native people very quickly find themselves being swarmed by colonists and their animals. What's more, the Wampanoag and more generally Native American expectation in this area and in almost all areas was that these guests would abide by the customs, the rules, the laws of their hosts. But that is not their intent. The English, like all Europeans of this era, saw themselves as Christian civilized people and Native people as savage pagans, and believed that by virtue of being civilized Christian people, they should lord it over the savage pagans and subject them to their laws and to their will, and to seize their territory if they had need for it. Well, Native people aren't going to concede to that. It's their country. And so the relationship starts to degenerate very, very quickly. And it's always just a question of when, not whether, there's going to be a major war.
And that happens with King Philip's War.
King Philip's War, which is named after the English name for Usamequin's or Massasoit's own son, Pametacom, Metacom, again, known as King Philip. The second generation of these people in contacts are at war with one another. And, you know, for that matter, Plymouth Colony is led by a guy, Josiah Winslow, whose father, Edward Winslow, had been one of the main points of contact between Plymouth Colony and the Wampanoags. He had doctored Wampanoag people. He had slept over their houses. He tried to speak their language. He knew them intimately and helped to create the conditions for which the alliance could flourish, under which the alliance could flourish. It's their very children who go to war with one another.
Dynamics change within a generation.
Within a generation, yeah.
I have many just questions to ask about this history, but I want to shift to something else that has grabbed my attention over the years. And your first chapter in your book is Mourning in America. Mourning as in mourning the loss of something.
Yes, not with a U.
With a U, thank you.
Right, yeah.
And there is actually a day called Day of Mourning. Is it Thanksgiving Day or the day after it?
Native people led by Wampanoag activists hold a day of mourning protest on Thanksgiving.
So, yeah, tell me about this.
In the town of Plymouth.
Oh, boy.
In the town of Plymouth, over on a hill beneath a statue of Massasoit and overlooking Plymouth Rock and a replica of the Mayflower. So, you know, the location is deeply symbolic.
Yeah.
And, you know, what they... This began in 1970, and a Quinna Wampanoag named Frank James had been asked by the state of Massachusetts to speak at the 350th anniversary of Plymouth's founding. And, you know, James is a very well-educated guy. He had a degree from New England Conservatory of Music. He was, you know, a fine trumpet player. He taught music in the Nauset Regional Public Schools out on Cape Cod, and he studied history. He was a native. He was an activist in Indian country. And so, you know, he wrote up what he thought was the approach, the appropriate talk for the 350th anniversary. And the state did not take too kindly to his
view
of it. And so when the state rejected his speech, he said, to hell with it. I'll deliver it anyway on my own terms. And organized this day of mourning protest, which attracted Native people from throughout New England and even across the country, members of the AIM movement, the American Indian movement, who were pushing red power, as they called it.
AAIM, American Indian Movement.
Okay. That's right. Yeah. They're probably best known for an armed standoff with the feds at Wounded Knee in the 1970s. They all showed up and the tradition stuck, and various Native people have continued to hold a day of mourning at that place and time every year up to now.
Why have we not heard about this? I mean, you're a professor of history and this is your interest. You almost never hear about this. TV, even on NPR. I don't think I've heard about this.
Native people are so marginalized in United States.
Even to this day.
I think it's worse today.
Oh, you think it's worse today?
Yeah, I do in a lot of ways. And here's why I say. Let's be clear about this and why it's so striking. There are more Native Americans than there are Jewish Americans. There are more Native Americans than there are Muslim Americans.
There are more Native Americans than there are Jewish Americans?
That is correct. And they control a larger portion of the country that territorially than I think most non-Native people understand. And yet we have been taught, both directly and indirectly, and you know, I think the subtle messages on this front are ubiquitous throughout our society, that Native people have disappeared, that they're extinct. And we're not taught, because we don't continue to follow Native America through history, they show up at the beginning, they might put up a brief resistance, and then they just go away.
Yeah,
we're not taught to see Native people as adapting through time and becoming fully modern members of society. So a Native person who has a short haircut and wears a suit and carries a briefcase, shops at the supermarket, drives a car, lives in a rectangular house, they're invisible to the broader American public.
But so is an Italian American or a Russian American, right?
Yes.
In that specific sense that you were saying, has a short haircut, lives in a rectangular house, drives a car. I wouldn't know if they're Italian American or Russian American or, whatever, Syrian American.
Right. But if they told you they were, you would accept at face value that they were who they said they were. When Native people look like you or I, and they say to others, oh, yeah, I'm Native American, I'm Wampanoag. People immediately start saying, well, do you live in a teepee? right? Do you speak English? I'm amazed you speak English. They start quizzing them on their authenticity. And the standard for authenticity is whether they live as outsiders imagined they lived back at the moment of contact. And of course, none of us live like our ancestors did 400 years ago. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to survive in modern society. Well, the same goes for Native people. There is a fundamental difference between Native Americans and other ethnic groups in the United States insofar as this. Mm-hmm. A, they were here first. They didn't choose to come here. They were already here. And B, they are sovereign nations. Jewish Americans aren't sovereign nations. Italian Americans are not sovereign nations. Indigenous people, if they're members of enrolled federally recognized tribes or state tribes, are sovereign, which means that to be Native American isn't just to say, oh, I descend from so-and-so or I perform these rituals. It means that you are a member of a political group that has sovereign rights within our society. Sovereign rights, by the way, which are guaranteed by Senate ratified treaties, which under the U.S. Constitution are the supreme law of the land. And so that makes them fundamentally different than anyone else in American society.
Do you think the tradition of Day of Mourning has brought more attention to the plight of Native American, or is it something that's largely ignored? As I share with you, I can't think of anyone that within my circle that even has heard of this.
Right. Well, I think a number of people in New England have heard of it. I've noticed in just the last couple of years, some major news organizations are starting to pick up on the story. The Washington Post just ran a feature this past week on this very point. But look, everyone loves Thanksgiving. Who wants to spend, this day?
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to mourn, it's going to be the behavior of our relatives after the day, after
exactly.
the holiday.
Who showed up unannounced, right?
that's right. Most people don't want to use the holiday to reflect on the crimes of the past.
Which goes back, give me a moment, let me read it. which goes back that serious critical history tends to be hard on the living. They don't want to have that on Thanksgiving holiday, right? It's hard. Right. It's hard to think of stuff like that.
That's right.
Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Professor Silverman as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Professor Silverman, on this 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving, our Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, is Native American. I think she's Laguna Pueblo Nation. Kevin Stitt, Governor of Oklahoma, is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and there are several Native American U.S. representatives. And we're more alert than ever before about social justice, this sort of the age of wokeness, and rightfully so, we got to know these things. But let's just go back to some of the questions I alluded to earlier in our podcast conversation. Every nation needs its feel-good traditions that unify. And I bet if we go back to other nations' histories, to sort of their feel-good nation history, they all will have some cruelty, some injustice, and ugliness in it. So I guess this is my question. How do we handle our Thanksgiving story? Are we overcorrecting here?
Oh, I don't think we're overcorrecting at all. Just because one generation's feel-good story worked for them mm-hmm. at a time in the past doesn't mean that feel-good story works for us now. And, you know, we're having a national battle over the character of this country. And my take on it is that the battle is over the legacy of white supremacy. White Americans have been dominant in this country from its very beginning and have constructed a series of myths and rituals that uphold that dominance. Well, the fact of the matter is we are a multicultural and multiracial nation. We have been from the beginning, even though whites have been the dominant group. And non-whites are their many white allies are no longer going to tolerate rituals, statues, and myths that uphold what they consider to be a fundamentally wrong and an unjust society.
So when you say they're not going to tolerate any longer, how do we deal with Thanksgiving then? Let's just get to basics like school plays.
Well, you know, look, let me be crystal clear uh-huh. about this point. I am not calling for an end to Thanksgiving. I am not declaring war on Thanksgiving. Yeah. I don't know any Native people who feel that way. And I don't know anyone who says we should replace Thanksgiving with a day of mourning. No one is saying that. What I'm suggesting here is that when we get together with family and friends and offer thanks for what's good in our lives, let us not attach that ritual, which all of us believe in, to a false history, which does damage to indigenous countrymen and women. Let me emphasize that. Our countrymen and women, right? They're part of this country. A national holiday should not be making light of their historical traumas or ignoring their historical traumas. A myth that blinds the rest of us to the fundamental colonial history of this country, what it was about. It's a brutal, brutal history. So let's look at that history square in the face. If we're going to attach the history of Plymouth colonists and Wampanoags to this holiday, and I don't think we need to or that we should, but if we're going to do it, well, then let's get it right. My job as a historian is to call out inaccuracies about the past as they're being articulated by our country's leaders. Believe me, you don't want to live in a country where historians are not doing that. Because
look at President Xi, what he's doing in China. He's changing the history of the last 70 years for his own benefit. Yeah.
Look at our last president. The historical lies were rampant. Yeah. You need historians to keep people honest on both sides of the political spectrum. Because Everyone in politics, no matter whether they're on the right or the left, want to harness history to their own political ambitions. Well, history usually doesn't lend itself neatly to the political agendas of modern day people. And so, you know, the job of historians like me is to do our best to keep society honest in the way it uses history. And so I am all for reinventing traditions, rituals, erecting new statues that meet the needs of our society and that reflect more accurately the past as we understand it.
And our Thanksgiving tradition sort of evolved to become what it is now. And I've read this, that up to during the 19th century, we really didn't have this thing called the Thanksgiving tradition, and it sort of evolved and became a national phenomena over the decades. In the same spirit, it can continue to evolve, right?
Based on that is correct. Throughout the 17th and the 18th century, and then well into the 19th, even New Englander, white New Englanders who celebrated Thanksgiving never invoked Pilgrims and Indians. That is a late 19th and 20th century invention.
Interesting.
We might call it revisionist history.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, all traditions are invented at one point or another, and they're invented for particular purposes at particular times. And just as those traditions were invented and other traditions discarded at those moments in time, we can do the same thing.
Evolve. If you wanted our audience to remember just one point about Thanksgiving, what would that be?
Colonialism is a bloody business. It always has been, and it always will be. And our country will be better off, painful as it is, to look at that bloody history square in the face and to come to terms with how it has shaped our society.
Wonderful. Professor Silverman, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to Adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.